At 7:30, as Steve Kemp was thinking tennis and Vic Trenton was reminding himself to call Joe Camber about his wife's balky pinto, Charity Camber was fixing her son's breakfast. Joe had left for Lewiston 30 minutes ago, hoping to find a 72 Camaro windshield at one of the city's automobile junkyards or used parts outfits. This jibed well with Charity's plans, which she had made slowly and carefully. She put Brett's plate of scrambled eggs and bacon in front of him and then sat down next to the boy. Brett glanced up from the book he was reading in mild surprise. After fixing his breakfast, his mother usually started on her round of morning chores. If you spoke to her too much before she got herself around a second cup of coffee, she was apt to show you the rough side of her tongue. "Can I talk to you a minute, Brett?" Mild surprise turned to something like amazement. Looking at her, he saw something utterly foreign in his mother's taciturn nature. She was nervous. He closed his book and said, "Sure, Mom." "Would you like..." She cleared her throat and began again. "How would you like to go down to Stratford, Connecticut, and see your Aunt Holly and your Uncle Jim and your cousins?" Brett grinned. He had only been out of Maine twice in his life, most recently with his father on a trip to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They had gone to a used car auction where Joe had picked up a 58 Ford with a Hemi engine. "Sure," he said. "When?" "I was thinking of Monday," she said. "After the weekend of the 4th. We'd be gone a week. Could you do that?"
"I guess. Geez, I thought Dad had a lot of work lined up for next week. He must have..."
"I haven't mentioned this to your father yet."
Brett's grin fell apart. He picked up a piece of bacon and began to eat it.
"Well, I know he promised Richie Sims he'd pull the motor on his international harvester, and Mr. Miller from the school was going to bring over his Ford because the tranny's shot, and
I just thought the two of us would go," Charity said,
"on the Greyhound from Portland." Brett looked doubtful. Outside the back porch screen, Cujo padded slowly up the steps and collapsed onto the boards in the shade with a grunt. He looked in at the boy and the woman with weary, red-rimmed eyes. He was feeling very bad now. Very bad indeed.
"Geez, Mom, I don't know."
"Don't say geez. It's just the same as swearing."
"Sorry."
"Would you like to go? If your father said it was all right?"
"Yeah, really."
"Do you really think we could?"
"Maybe." She was looking out through the window over the sink, thoughtfully.
"How far is it to Stratford, Mom?"
"About 350 miles, I guess."
"Gee, I mean, boy, that's a long way. Is it..."
"Brett?" He looked at her attentively. That curious, intense quality was back in her voice and on her face, that nervousness.
"What, Mom?"
"Can you think of anything your father needs out in the shop? Any one thing he's been looking to get?"
The light dawned in Brett's eyes a little. "Well, he always needs adjustable wrenches, and he's been wanting a new set of ball and sockets, and he could use a new welder's helmet since the old one got a crack in the faceplate."
"No, I mean anything big. Expensive."
Brett thought a while, then smiled.
"Well,
What he'd really like is to have a new Jurgen chainfall, I guess. Rip that old motor out of Richie Sims International just as slick as Well, slick.
He blushed and hurried on. But you couldn't get him nothing like that, Mom. That's really dear.
Dear, Joe's word for expensive. She hated it.
How much?
Well, the one in the catalog says $1,700, but Dad could probably get it from Mr. Belasco at Portland Machine for wholesale. Dad says Mr. Belasco's scared of him.
Do you think there's something smart about that? She asked sharply.
Brett sat back in his chair, a little frightened by her fierceness. He couldn't remember his mother ever acting quite like this. Even Cujo, out on the porch, pricked his ears a little.
Well, do you?
No, Mom, he said. But Charity knew in a despairing way that he was lying. If you could scare somebody into giving you wholesale, you were trading a right smart. She had heard the admiration in Brett's voice, even if the boy himself had not.
Wants to be just like him. Thinks his daddy is just standing tall when he scares someone. Oh, my God.
There's nothing smart about being able to scare people, Charity said. All it takes is a big voice and a mean disposition. There's no smart to it.
She lowered her voice and flapped a hand at him.
Go on and eat your eggs. I'm not going to shout at you.
I guess it's the heat.
He ate, but quietly and carefully, looking at her now and then. There were hidden mines around this morning.
What would wholesale be, I wonder? $1,300? $1,000?
I don't know, Mama.
Would this Belasco deliver on a big order like that?
Yeah, I guess he would, if we had that kind of money.
Her hand went to the pocket of her house dress. The lottery ticket was there. The green number on her ticket, 76, and the red number, 434, matched to the numbers drawn by the State Lottery Commission 2 weeks before. She had checked it dozens of times, unable to believe it. She had invested 50 cents that week, as she had done every week since the lottery began in 1975, and this time she had won $5,000. She hadn't cashed the ticket in yet, but neither had she let it out of her sight or her reach since she found out.
We do have that kind of money, she said.
Brett goggled at her.
At 10:15, Vic slipped out of his AdWorks office and went around to Bentley's for his morning coffee, unable to face the bitch's brew that was available at the office. He had spent the morning writing ads for DeCoster Egg Farms. It was hard going. He had hated eggs since his boyhood, when his mother grimly forced one down his throat 4 days a week. The best he had been able to come up with so far was Eggs Say Love, Seamlessly. Not very good. Seamlessly had given him the idea of a trick photo which would show an egg with a zipper running around its middle. It was a good image, but where did it lead? No place that he had been able to discover. Ought to ask the Tadder, he thought, as the waitress brought him coffee and a blueberry muffin. Tad liked eggs. It wasn't really the egg ad that was bringing him down, of course. It was having to take off for 12 days. Well, it had to be. Roger had convinced him of that. They would have to get in there and pitch like hell. Good old garrulous Roger, whom Vic loved almost like a brother. Roger would have been more than glad to cruise down here to Bentley's with him, to have a coffee with him, and to talk his ear off.
But this one time, Vic needed to be alone, to think. The two of them would be spending most of 2 weeks together starting Monday, sweating it out, and that was quite enough, even for soul brothers. His mind turned toward the Red Raspberry Zingers fiasco again, and he let it, knowing that sometimes a no-pressure, almost idle review of a bad situation could, for him at least, result in some new insight, a fresh angle. What had happened was bad enough, and Zingers had been withdrawn from the market. Bad enough, but not terrible. It wasn't like that canned mushroom thing. No one had gotten sick or died, and even consumers realized that a company could take a pratfall now and then. Look at that McDonald's glass giveaway a couple 3 years ago. The paint on the glasses had been found to contain an unacceptably high lead content. The glasses had been withdrawn quickly, consigned to that promotional limbo inhabited by creatures such as Speedy Alka-Seltzer and Vic's own personal favorite, Big Dick Chewing Gum. The glasses had been bad for the McDonald's Corporation, but no one had accused Ronald McDonald of trying to poison his preteen constituency. And no one had actually accused the Sharp Cereal Professor either, although comedians from Bob Hope to Steve Martin had taken potshots at him, and Johnny Carson had run off an entire monologue, couched in careful double entendre, about the Red Raspberry Zingers affair one evening during his opening spot on The Tonight Show. Needless to say, the Sharp Cereal Professor ads had been jerked from the tube. Also, needless to say, the character actor who played the professor was wild at the way events had turned on him.
"I could imagine a worse situation," Roger had said after the first shockwaves had subsided a bit and the thrice-daily long-distance calls between Portland and Cleveland were no longer flying.
"What?" Vic had asked.
"Well," Roger had answered, straight-faced, "we could be working on the Bon Vivant Vichyssoise account."
"More coffee, sir?" Vic glanced up at the waitress. He started to say no, then nodded.
"Half a cup, please," he said.
She poured it and left. Vic stirred it randomly, not drinking it. There had been a mercifully brief health scare before a number of doctors spoke up on TV and in the papers, all of them saying the coloration was harmless. There had been something like it once before. The stews on a commercial airline had been struck down with weird orange skin discolorations, which finally proved to be nothing more serious than a rub-off of the orange dye on the life jackets they demonstrated for their passengers before takeoff. Years before that, the food dye in a certain brand of Frankfurters had produced an internal effect similar to that of Red Raspberry Zingers. Old Man Sharp's lawyers had lodged a multi-million-dollar damage suit against the dye manufacturer, a case that would probably drag on for 3 years and then be settled out of court. No matter. The suit provided a forum from which to make the public aware that the fault, the totally temporary fault, the completely harmless fault, had not been that of the Sharp Company. Nonetheless, Sharp stock had tumbled sharply on the big board. It had since made up less than half the original drop. The cereals themselves had shown a sudden dip in sales, but had since made up most of the ground that had been lost after Zingers showed its treacherous red face. Sharp's all-grain blend, in fact, was doing better than ever before. So, there was nothing wrong here, right? Wrong. So wrong. The Sharp Cereal Professor was what was wrong. The poor guy would never be able to make a comeback. After the scare come the laughs, and the professor, with his sober mien and his schoolroom surroundings, had been literally laughed to death. George Carlin, in his nightclub routine, "Yeah, it's a crazy world, crazy world.
Carlin bends his head over his mic for a moment, meditating, and then looks up again. The Reagan guys are doing their campaign shit on TV, right? Russians are getting ahead of us in the arms race. The Russians are turning out missiles by the thousands, right? So Jimmy gets on TV to do one of his spots, and he says, "My fellow Americans, the day the Russians get ahead of us in the arms race will be the day the youth of America shits red." Big laugh from the audience. So Ronnie gets on the phone to Jimmy, and he says, "Mr. President, what did Amy have for breakfast?" A gigantic laugh from the audience. Carlin pauses. The real punchline is then delivered in a low, insinuating tone. "Nope. Nothing wrong here." The audience roars its approval, applauds wildly. Carlin shakes his head sadly. "Red shit, man. Wow. Dig on it a while." That was the problem. George Carlin was the problem. Bob Hope was the problem. Johnny Carson was the problem. Steve Martin was the problem. Every barbershop wit in America was the problem. And then consider this. Sharp stock had gone down 9 and had only rebounded 4.25. The shareholders were going to be hollering for somebody's head. Let's see, whose do we give them? Who had the bright idea of the Sharp cereal professor in the first place? How about those guys as the most eligible? Never mind the fact that the professor had been on for 4 years before the Zingers debacle. Never mind the fact that when the Sharp cereal professor and his cohorts, the Cookie Sharpshooter and George and Gracie, had come on the scene, Sharp stock had been 3.25 points lower than it was now. Never mind all that. Mind this instead. Just the fact, just the public announcement in the trades that AdWorks had lost the Sharp account. Just that would probably cause shares to bob up another 1.5 to 2 points. And when a new ad campaign actually began, investors would take it as a sign that the old woes were finally behind the company and the stock might creep up another 1 point. Of course, Vic thought, stirring sweet and low into his coffee, that was only theory. And even if the theory turned out to be true, both he and Roger believed that a short-run gain for Sharp would be more than offset if a new ad campaign, hastily thrown together by people who didn't know the Sharp company as he and Roger did, or the competitive cereal market in general, didn't do the job. And suddenly, that new slant, that fresh angle, popped into his mind. It came unbidden and unexpected. His coffee cup paused halfway to his mouth, and his eyes widened. In his mind, he saw two men, perhaps him and Roger, perhaps old man Sharp and his aging kid, filling in a grave. Their spades were flying. A lantern flickered fitfully in the windy night. Rain was drizzling down. These corporate sextons threw an occasional furtive glance behind them. It was a burial by night, a covert act performed in the darkness. They were burying the Sharp cereal professor in secret. And that was wrong. "Wrong," he muttered aloud. Sure it was. Because if they buried him in the dead of night, he could never say what he had to say. That he was sorry. He took his Pentel pen from his inner coat pocket, took a napkin from the holder, and wrote swiftly across it, "The Sharp cereal professor needs to apologize." He looked at it. The letters were getting larger, fuzzing as the ink sank into the napkin. Below that first sentence, he added, "Decent burial." And below that, "Daylight burial." He still wasn't sure what it meant. It was more metaphor than sense, but that was how his best ideas came to him.
And there was something there. He felt sure of it.
Cujo lay on the floor of the garage in semi-gloom. It was hot in here, but it was even worse outside, and the daylight outside was too bright. It never had been before. In fact, he had never even really noticed the quality of the light before. But he was noticing now. Cujo's head hurt. His muscles hurt. The bright light made his eyes hurt. He was hot, and his muzzle still ached where he had been scratched. Ached and festered. The man was gone somewhere. Not long after he left, the boy and the woman had gone somewhere, leaving him alone. The boy had put a big dish of food out for Cujo, and Cujo had eaten a little bit. The food made him feel worse instead of better, and he left the rest of it alone. Now there was the growl of a truck turning into the driveway. Cujo got up and went to the barn door, knowing already it was a stranger. He knew the sound of both the man's truck and the family car. He stood in the doorway, head poking out into the bright glare that hurt his eyes. The truck backed up the driveway and then stopped. Two men got down from the cab and came around to the back. One of them ran up the truck's sliding back door. The rattling, banging noise hurt Cujo's ears. He whined and retreated back into the comforting gloom. The truck was from Portland Machine. 3 hours ago, Charity Camber and her still-dazzled son had gone into Portland Machine's main office on Brighton Avenue, and she had written a personal check for a new Jürgen Chainfall. Wholesale had turned out to be exactly $1,241.71, tax included. Before going to Portland Machine, she had gone into the state liquor store on Congress Street to fill out a lottery claim form. Brett, forbidden absolutely to come inside with her, stood on the sidewalk with his hands in his pockets. The clerk told Charity she would get a lottery commission check in the mail. How long? 2 weeks at the very outside. It would come minus a deduction of roughly $800 for taxes. This sum was based on her declaration of Joe's yearly income. The deduction for taxes before the fact did not anger Charity at all. Up until the moment when the clerk had checked her number against his sheet, she had been holding her breath, still unable to believe this had really happened to her. Then the clerk had nodded, congratulated her, and even called the manager out of his office to meet her. None of that mattered. What mattered was that now she could breathe again, and the ticket was no longer her responsibility. It had returned to the bowels of the lottery commission. Her check would be in the mail. Wonderful, mystical, talismanic phrase. And still she felt a small pang as she watched the dog-eared ticket, limp with her own nervous perspiration, clipped to the form she had filled out and then stored away. Lady Luck had singled her out. For the first time in her life, maybe for the only time, that heavy muslin drape of the everyday had been twitched a little, showing her a bright and shining world beyond. She was a practical woman, and in her heart she knew that she hated her husband more than a little, and feared him more than a little, but that they would grow old together, and he would die, leaving her with his debts, and this she would not admit for sure even in her secret heart, but now she feared it, perhaps with his spoilt son. If her name had been plucked from the big drum in the twice-yearly super drawing, if she had won 10 times the $5,000 she had won, she might have entertained notions of pushing aside that dull muslin curtain, taking her son by the hand, and leading them both out into whatever was beyond Town Road Number 3 and Camber's Garage, Foreign Cars Our Specialty, and Castle Rock.
She might have taken Brett to Connecticut with the express purpose of asking her sister how much a small apartment in Stratford would cost. But it had only been a twitch of the curtain. That was all. She had seen Lady Luck for a bare brief moment, as wonderful, puzzling, and inexplicable as a bright fairy dancing under mushrooms in the dewy light of dawn. Seen once, never again. So she felt a pang when the ticket disappeared from her view, even though it had robbed her sleep. She understood that she would buy a lottery ticket a week for the rest of her life and never win more than $2 all at once. Never mind. You don't count teeth in a gift horse. Not if you were smart. They went out to Portland Machine, and she had written the check, reminding herself to stop at the bank on their way home and transfer enough money from savings to checking so that the check wouldn't bounce. She and Joe had a little over $4,000 in their savings account after 15 years, just about enough to cover three-quarters of their outstanding debts, if you excluded the mortgage on the farm. She had no right to exclude that, of course, but she always did. She could not bring herself to think about the mortgage except payment by payment. But they could dent the savings all they wanted to now, and then deposit the lottery commission check in that account when it came. All they would be losing was 2 weeks' interest. The man from Portland Machine, Louis Belasco, said he would have the chain fall delivered that very afternoon, and he was as good as his word. Joe Magruder and Ronnie Dubay got the chain fall on the truck's pneumatic step-loader, and it whooshed gently down to the dirt driveway on a sigh of air.
"Pretty big order for old Joe Camber," Ronnie said.
Magruder nodded.
"Put it in the barn," his wife said. "That's his garage. Better get a good hold, Ronnie. This is a heavy hoa."
Joe Magruder got his hold, Ronnie got his, and, puffing and grunting, the two of them half walked it, half carried it into the barn.
"Let's set it down a minute," Ronnie managed. "I can't see where the hell I'm going. Let's get used to the dark before we go ass over cow catcher."
They set the chainfall down with a thump. After the bright afternoon glare outside, Joe was mostly blinded. He could only make out the vague shapes of things, a car up on jacks, a workbench, a sense of beams going up to a loft.
"This thing ought,"
Ronnie began, and then stopped abruptly. Coming out of the darkness from beyond the front end of the jacked-up car was a low, guttural growling. Ronnie felt the sweat he had worked up suddenly turn clammy, the hairs on the back of his neck stirred.
"Holy crow, you hear that?" Magruder whispered.
Ronnie could see Joe now. Joe's eyes were big and scared-looking.
"I hear it."
It was a sound as low as a powerful outboard engine idling. Ronnie knew it took a big dog to make a sound like that. And when a big dog did, it more often than not meant business. He hadn't seen a beware of dog sign when they drove up, but sometimes these bumpkins from the boonies didn't bother with one. He knew one thing. He hoped to God that the dog making that sound was chained up.
"Joe, you ever been out here before?"
"Once. It's a St. Bernard, big as a fucking house. He didn't do that before."
Joe gulped. Ronnie heard something in his throat click.
"Oh, God. Look at there, Ronnie."
Ronnie's eyes had come partway to adjusting, and his half-sight lent what he was seeing a spectral, almost supernatural cast. He knew you never showed a mean dog your fear. They could smell it coming off you. But he began to shudder helplessly anyway. He couldn't help it. The dog was a monster. It was standing deep in the barn, beyond the jacked-up car. It was a St. Bernard, for sure. There was no mistaking the heavy coat, tawny even in the shadows, the breadth of shoulder. Its head was down. Its eyes glared at them with steady, sunken animosity. It wasn't on a chain.
"Back up slow," Joe said. "Don't run, for Christ's sake."
They began to back up, and as they did, the dog began to walk slowly forward. It was a stiff walk, not really a walk at all, Ronnie thought. It was a stalk. That dog wasn't fucking around. Its engine was running and it was ready to go. Its head remained low. That growl never changed pitch. It took a step forward for every step they took back. For Joe Magruder, the worst moment came when they backed into the bright sunlight again. It dazzled him, blinded him. He could no longer see the dog. If it came for him now... Reaching behind him, he felt the side of the truck. That was enough to break his nerve. He bolted for the cab. On the other side, Ronnie Dubay did the same. He reached the passenger door and fumbled at the latch for an endless moment. He clawed at it. He could still hear that low growling, so much like an idling Evinrude 80-horsepower motor. The door wouldn't open. He waited for the dog to pull a chunk of his ass off. At last his thumb found the button, the door opened, and he scrambled into the cab, panting. He looked in the rearview mirror bolted outside his window and saw the dog standing in the open barn door, motionless. He looked over at Joe, who was sitting behind the wheel and grinning at him sheepishly. Ronnie offered his own shaky grin in return.
"Just a dog," Ronnie said. "Yeah, back's worse than his bite."
"Right. Let's go back in there and screw around with that chain fall some more."
"Fuck you," Joe said.
"And the horse you rode in on." They laughed together. Ronnie passed him a smoke.
"What do you say we get going?"
"I'm your guy," Joe said, and started the truck. Halfway back to Portland, Ronnie said, almost to himself, "That dog's going bad." Joe was driving with his elbow cocked out the window. He glanced over at Ronnie.
"I was scared, and I don't mind saying so. One of those little dogs gives me shit in a situation like that with nobody home. I'd just as soon kick it in the balls, you know? I mean, if people don't chain up a dog that bites, they deserve what they get, you know? That thing, did you see it?
I bet that mother humper went 200 pounds.
Maybe I ought to give Joe Camber a call, Ronnie said. Tell him what happened. Might save him getting his arm chewed off. What do you think?
What's Joe Camber done for you lately? Joe Magruder asked with a grin. Ronnie nodded thoughtfully.
He don't blow me like you do, that's true. Last blow job I had was from your wife. Wasn't half bad either. Get bent, you fairy.
They laughed together. Nobody called Joe Camber. When they got back to Portland Machine, it was near knocking off time. Screwing around time. They took 15 minutes riding the trip up. Belasco came out back and asked them if Camber had been there to take delivery. Ronnie Dubay said sure. Belasco, who was a prick of the highest order, went away. Joe Magruder told Ronnie to have a nice weekend and a happy fucking fourth. Ronnie said he planned to get in the bag and stay that way until Sunday night. They clocked out. Neither of them thought about Cujo again until they read about him in the paper. Vic spent most of that afternoon before the long weekend going over the details of the trip with Roger.
Roger was so careful about details that he was almost paranoid. He had made the plane and hotel reservations through an agency. Their flight to Boston would leave Portland Jetport at 7:10 a.m. Monday. Vic said he would pick Roger up in the Jag at 5:30. He thought that was unnecessarily early, but he knew Roger and Roger's little tics. They talked generally about the trip, consciously avoiding specifics. Vic kept his coffee break ideas to himself, and the napkin stowed safely away in his sports jacket pocket. Roger would be more receptive when they were away. Vic thought about leaving early and decided to go back and check the afternoon mail first. Lisa, their secretary, had already left for the day, getting a jump on the holiday weekend. Hell, you couldn't get a secretary to stay until the stroke of five anymore, holiday weekend or not. As far as Vic was concerned, it was just another sign of the continuing decay of Western Civ. Probably at this very moment, Lisa, who was beautiful, just 21, and almost totally breastless, was entering the interstate flow of traffic bound south to Old Orchard or the Hamptons, dressed in tight jeans and a nothing halter. Get down, disco Lisa, Vic thought, and grinned a little. There was a single unopened letter on his desk blotter. He picked it up curiously, noting first the word personal printed below the address, and second, the fact that his address had been printed in solid caps. He held it, turning it over in his hands, feeling a vague thread of disquiet slip into what was a general mood of tired well-being. Far back in his mind, hardly even acknowledged, was a sudden urge to rip the letter into halves, fourths, eighths, and then toss the pieces into the wastebasket. Instead, he tore it open and pulled out a single sheet of paper. More block letters. The simple message, six sentences, hit him like a straight shot just below the heart. He did not so much sit in his chair as collapse into it. A little grunt escaped him, the sound of a man who has suddenly lost all his wind. His mind roared with nothing but white noise for a length of time he didn't, couldn't understand or comprehend. If Roger had come in just then, he likely would have thought Vic was having a heart attack. In a way, he was. His face was paper white, his mouth hung open, bluish half-moons had appeared under his eyes. He read the message again, and then again. At first, his eyes were drawn to the first interrogative. What's that mole just above her pubic hair look like to you? It's a mistake, he thought confusedly. No one knows about that but me. Well, her mother and her father. Then, hurt, he felt the first splinters of jealousy. Even her bikini covers that. Her little bikini. He ran a hand through his hair. He put the letter down and ran both hands through his hair. That punched, gasping feeling was still there in his chest, the feeling that his heart was pumping air instead of blood. He felt fright and pain and confusion, but of the three, the dominant feeling, the overriding emotion, was terrible fright. The letter glared up at him and shouted, "I enjoyed fucking the shit out of her." Now it was this line his eyes fixed upon, not wanting to leave. He could hear the drone of a plane in the sky outside, leaving the jetport, heading up, heading out, making for points unknown. And he thought, I enjoyed fucking the shit out of her. Crude. That's crude. Yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. Yes, indeedy. It was the hack of a blunt knife, fucking the shit out of her. What an image that made.
Nothing fancy about it. It was like getting a splash in the eyes from a squirt gun loaded up with battery acid. He tried hard to think coherently, and I enjoyed, just couldn't, fucking the shit out of her. Do it. Now his eyes went to the last line, and that was the one he read over and over again, as if trying to cram the sense of it somehow into his brain, that huge feeling of fright kept getting in the way.
Do you have any questions?
Yes. All of a sudden, he had all kinds of questions. The only thing was, he didn't seem to want answers to any of them. A new thought crossed his mind. What if Roger hadn't gone home? Often he poked his head into Vic's office before leaving if there was a light on. He might be even more likely to do so tonight with the trip pending. The thought made Vic feel panicky, and an absurd memory surfaced. All those times he had spent masturbating in the bathroom as a teenager, unable to help himself but terribly afraid everyone must know exactly what he was up to in there. If Roger came in, he would see something was wrong. He didn't want that. He got up and went to the window, which looked down 6 stories to the parking lot which served the building. Roger's bright yellow Honda Civic was gone from its space. He had gone home. Pulled out of himself, Vic listened. The offices of AdWorks were totally silent. There was that resonating quiet that seems the sole property of business quarters after hours. There was not even the sound of old Mr. Stegmeyer, the custodian, rattling around. He would have to sign out in the lobby. He would have to... Now, there was a sound. At first he didn't know what it was. It came to him in a moment. It was whimpering. The sound of an animal with a smashed foot. Still looking out the window, he saw the cars left in the parking lot double, then treble through a film of tears. Why couldn't he get mad? Why did he have to be so fucking scared? An absurd antique word came to mind. Jilted, he thought. I've been jilted. The whimpering sounds kept coming. He tried to lock his throat, and it did no good. He lowered his head and gripped the convector grill that ran below the window at waist height, gripped it until his fingers hurt, until the metal creaked and protested. How long had it been since he had cried? He had cried the night Tad was born, but that had been relief. He had cried when his dad died after fighting grimly for his life for 3 days after a massive heart attack struck him. And those tears, shed at 17, had been like these, burning, not wanting to come. It was more like bleeding than crying. But at 17, it was easier to cry, easier to bleed. When you were 17, you still expected to have to do your share of both. He stopped whimpering. He thought it was done. And then a low cry came out of him, a harsh, wavering sound, and he thought, was that me? God, was it me that made that sound? The tears began to slide down his cheeks. There was another harsh sound, then another. He gripped the convector grill and cried. 40 minutes later, he was sitting in Deering Oaks Park. He had called home and told Donna he would be late. She started to ask why, and why he sounded so strange. He told her he would be home before dark. He told her to go ahead and feed Tad. Then he hung up before she could say anything else. Now he was sitting in the park. The tears had burned off most of the fear.
What was left was an ugly slag of anger. That was the next level in this geological column of knowledge. But anger wasn't the right word. He was enraged. He was infuriated. It was as if he had been stung by something. A part of him had recognized that it would be dangerous for him to go home now, dangerous for all three of them. It would be so pleasurable to hide the wreckage by making more. It would, let's face it, be so mindlessly pleasurable to punch her cheating face in. He was sitting beside the duck pond. On the other side, a spirited frisbee game was going on. He noticed that all four of the girls playing and two of the boys were on roller skates. Roller skates were big this summer. He saw a young girl in a tube top pushing a cart of pretzels, peanuts, and canned soft drinks. Her face was soft and fresh and innocent. One of the guys playing frisbee flipped her the disc. She caught it deftly and flipped it back. In the 60s, Vic thought, she would have been in a commune, diligently picking bugs off tomato plants. Now she was probably a member in good standing of the Small Business Administration. He and Roger used to come down here to eat their lunches sometimes. That had been in the first year. Then Roger noticed that, although the pond looked lovely, there was a faint but definite odor of putridity hanging around it. And the small house on the rock in the center of the pond was whitewashed not with paint, but with gull shit. A few weeks later, Vic had noted a decaying rat floating amid the condoms and gum wrappers at the edge of the pond. He didn't think they had been back since then. The frisbee, a bright red, floated across the sky. The image that had provoked his anger kept recurring. He couldn't keep it away. It was as crude as his anonymous correspondent's choice of words had been, but he couldn't ditch it. He saw them screwing in his and Donna's bedroom, screwing in their bed. What he saw in this mind movie was every bit as explicit as one of those grainy X-rated pictures you could see at the State Theater on Congress Street. She was groaning, sheened lightly with perspiration, beautiful, every muscle pulled taut. Her eyes had that hungry look they got when the sex was good, their color darker. He knew the expression, he knew the posture, he knew the sounds. He had thought he was the only one who did. Not even her mother and father would know about that. Then he would think of the man's penis, his cock going up inside her. In the saddle, that phrase came and clanged in his mind idiotically, refusing to die away. He saw them screwing to a Gene Autry soundtrack. It made him feel creepy. It made him feel outraged. It made him feel infuriated. The frisbee soared and came down. Vic followed its course. He had suspected something, yes. But suspecting was not like knowing. He knew that now, if nothing else. He could write an essay on the difference between suspecting and knowing. What made it doubly cruel was the fact that he had really begun to believe that the suspicions were groundless. And even if they weren't, what you didn't know couldn't hurt you. Wasn't that right? If a man is crossing a darkened room with a deep open hole in the middle of it, and if he passes within inches of it, he doesn't need to know he almost fell in. There is no need for fear. Not if the lights are off. Well, he hadn't fallen in. He had been pushed. The question was, what was he going to do about it? The angry part of him, hurt, bruised, and bellowing, was not in the slightest inclined to be adult, to acknowledge that there were slips on one or both sides in a great many marriages.
Fuck the penthouse forum, or variations, or whatever they're calling it these days. That's my wife we're talking about. She was screwing someone. When my back was turned, when Tad was out of the house.
The images began to unreel again. Crumpled sheets, straining bodies, soft sounds.
Ugly phrases, terrible terms kept crowding up like a bunch of freaks looking at an accident. Nookie, hair pie, put the boots to her, shot my load. I don't fuck for fortune and I don't fuck for fame, but the way I fuck your mama is a goddamn shame. My turtle in your mud, bang for the gang, stoop for the troops. Inside my wife! He thought, agonized, hands clenching. Inside my wife.
But the angry, hurt part acknowledged, grudgingly, that he couldn't go home and beat the hell out of Donna. He could, however, take Tad and go. Never mind the explanations. Let her try and stop him if she had cheek enough to do it. He didn't think she would. Take Tad, go to a motel, get a lawyer, cut the cord cleanly, and don't look back. But if he just grabbed Tad and took him to a motel, wouldn't the boy be frightened? Wouldn't he want an explanation? He was only 4. But that was old enough to know when something was badly, frighteningly wrong. Then there was the matter of the trip, Boston, New York, Cleveland. Vic didn't give a goddamn about the trip, not now. Old man Sharp and his kid could take a flying jump at the moon for all he cared. But he wasn't in it alone. He had a partner. The partner had a wife and 2 kids. Even now, hurting as badly as he was, Vic recognized his responsibility to at least go through the motions of trying to save the account, which was tantamount to trying to save AdWorks itself. And although he didn't want to ask it, there was another question. Exactly why did he want to take Tad and go without even hearing her side of the story? Because her sleeping around was wrecking Tad's morals? He didn't think so. It was because his mind had immediately seized upon the fact that the way to hurt her most surely and most deeply as he hurt right now, was through Tad. But did he want to turn his son into the emotional equivalent of a crowbar or a sledgehammer? He thought not. Other questions. The note. Think about the note for a minute. Not just what it said, not just those 6 lines of battery acid filth. Think about the fact of the note. Someone had just killed the goose that had been, pardon the pun, laying the golden eggs. Why had Donna's lover sent that note? Because the goose was no longer laying, of course. And the shadow man who had sent the note was mad as hell. Had Donna dumped the guy? He tried to see it any other way and couldn't. Stripped of its sudden shocking force, wasn't "I enjoyed fucking the shit out of her" the classic dog in the manger ploy? If you can't have it anymore, piss on it so no one else will want it either. Illogical, but so satisfying. The new, easier atmosphere at home fit into that reading as well. The almost palpable sense of relief Donna radiated. She had turned the shadow man out, and the shadow man had hit back at her husband with the anonymous note. Last question. Did it make any difference? He took the note out of his jacket pocket again and turned it over and over in his hands, not unfolding it. He watched the red frisbee float across the sky and wondered what the hell he was going to do.
"What the Christ is that?" Joe Camber asked.
Each word came out spaced, almost inflectionless. He stood in the doorway looking at his wife. Charity was setting his place. She and Brett had already eaten. Joe had come in with a truck full of odds and ends, had begun to drive into the garage, and had seen what was waiting for him. "It's a chainfall," she said. She had sent Brett over to play with his buddy Dave Bergeron for the evening. She didn't want him around if this went badly. "Brett said you wanted one. A Jürgen chainfall," he said. Joe crossed the room. He was a thin man with a scrawny, strong physique, a big blade nose, and a quiet, agile way of walking. Now his green felt hat was tipped back on his head to show his receding hairline. There was a smudge of grease on his forehead. There was beer on his breath. His brown eyes were small and hard. He was a man who didn't like surprises.
"You talk to me, Charity," he said.
"Sit down. Your supper will get cold." His arm shot out like a piston. Hard fingers bit into her arm.
"What the fuck are you up to? Talk to me," I said.
"Don't curse at me, Joe Camber." He was hurting her badly, but she wouldn't give him the satisfaction of seeing it in her face or in her eyes. He was like a beast in many ways, and although this had excited her when she was young, it excited her no longer. She had recognized over the course of their years together that she could sometimes gain the upper hand just by seeming brave. Not always, but sometimes.
"You tell me what the fuck you've been up to, Charity."
"Sit down and eat," she said quietly, "and I will." He sat down and she brought his plate. There was a sirloin steak on it.
"Since when can we afford to eat like the Rockefellers?" he asked. "You got some pretty tall explaining to do, I'd say."
She brought his coffee and a split baked potato. "Can't you use the chainfall?"
"Never said I couldn't use it, but I damn well can't afford it."
He began to eat, his eyes never leaving her. He wouldn't hit her now, she knew. This was her chance, while he was still relatively sober. If he was going to hit her, it would be after he came back from Gary Pervier's, sloshing with vodka and filled with wounded male pride. Charity sat down across from him and said, "I won the lottery." His jaws halted and then began moving again. He forked steak into his mouth.
"Sure," he said. "And tomorrow, old Cujo out there's gonna shit a mess of gold buttons."
He pointed his fork at the dog, who was pacing restlessly up and down the porch. Brett didn't like to take him over to the Bergerons because they had rabbits in a hutch and they drove Cujo wild. Charity reached into her apron pocket, took out her copy of the prize claim form that the agent had filled out, and handed it across the table to Joe. Camber flattened the paper out with one blunt-fingered hand and stared it up and down, his eyes centered on the figure.
"Five,"
he began, and then shut his mouth with a snap. Charity watched him, saying nothing. He didn't smile, he didn't come around the table and kiss her. For a man with his turn of mind, she thought bitterly, good fortune only meant that something was lying in wait. He looked up at last.
"You won $5,000?
"Less taxes, Aya."
"How long you been playing the lottery?"
"I buy a 50-center every week. And you don't dare dun me about it either, Joe Camber, with all the beer you buy."
"Watch your mouth, Charity," he said.
His eyes were unblinking, brilliant blue.
"Just watch your mouth, or it might swell up on you all at once."
He began to eat his steak again, and behind the set mask of her face, she relaxed a little. She had thrust the chair in the tiger's face for the first time, and it hadn't bitten her. At least, not yet.
"This money,
When do we get it?
The check will come in 2 weeks or a little less. I bought the chain fall out of the money that's in our savings account. That claim farm is just as good as gold. That's what the agent said.
You went out and bought that thing?
I asked Brett what he thought you'd want most. It's a present.
Thanks.
He went on eating. I got you a present, she said. Now you give me one, Joe. Okay? He went on eating, and he went on looking at her. He didn't say anything. His eyes were totally expressionless. He was eating with his hat on, still pushed back on his head. She spoke to him slowly, deliberately, knowing it would be a mistake to rush. I want to go away for a week, with Brett, to see Holly and Jim down in Connecticut.
No, he said, and went on eating.
We could go on the bus. We'd stay with them. It would be cheap. There would be plenty of money left over. That found money. It wouldn't cost a third of what that chainfall cost. I called the bus station and asked them about the round-trip fare.
No, I need Brett here to help me.
She clutched her hands together in a hard, twisting fury under the table, but made her face remain calm and smooth. You get along without him in the school year.
I said no, Charity, he said. And she saw with galling, bitter certainty that he was enjoying this. He saw how much she wanted this, how she had planned for it. He was enjoying her pain.
She got up and went to the sink, not because she had anything to do there, but because she needed time to get herself under control. The evening star peeped in at her, high and remote. She ran water. The porcelain was a discolored yellowish color. Like Joe, their water was hard. Maybe disappointed, feeling that she had given up too easily, Camber elaborated.
The boy's got to learn some responsibility. Won't hurt him to help me this summer instead of running off to Davy Bergeron's every day and night.
She turned off the water. I sent him over there.
You did? Why?
Because I thought it might go like this, she said, turning back to him. But I told him you'd say yes, what with the money and the chain fall.
If you knew better, you sinned against the boy, Joe said. Next time, I guess you'll think before you throw your tongue in gear.
He smiled at her through a mouthful of food and reached for the bread.
You could come with us if you wanted.
Sure. I'll just tell Richie Sims to forget getting in his first cutting this summer. Besides, why do I want to go down and see them too? From what I've seen of them and what you tell of them, I got to think they're a couple of first-class snots. Only reason you like them is because you'd like to be a snot just like them.
His voice was gradually rising. He began to spray food. When he got like this, he frightened her, and she gave in. Most times. She would not do that tonight.
Mostly you'd like the boy to be a snot like them. That's what I think. You'd like to turn him against me, I guess. Am I wrong?
Why don't you ever call him by his name?
You want to just shut the crap house door now, Charity, he said, looking at her hard.
A flush had crept up his cheeks and across his forehead.
Mind me now.
No, she said. That's not the end.
He dropped his fork, astounded.
What? What did you say?
She walked toward him, allowing herself the luxury of total anger for the first time in her marriage,
But it was all inside, burning and sloshing like acid. She could feel it eating. She daren't shout. To shout would be the end for sure. She kept her voice low. Yes, you'd think that about my sister and her husband. Sure you would. Look at you, sitting there and eating with your dirty hands and your hat still on. You don't want him down there seeing how other people live, just the same way I don't want him seeing how you and your friends live when you're off to yourselves. That's why I wouldn't let him go on that hunting trip with you last November. She paused, and he only sat there, a half-eaten slice of Wonder Bread in one hand, steak juice on his chin. She thought that the only thing keeping him from springing at her was his total amazement that she should be saying these things at all. "So, I'll trade with you," she said. "I've got you that chainfall, and I'm willing to hand over the rest of the money to you. Lots wouldn't. But if you're going to be so ungrateful, I'll go you one more. You let him go down with me to Connecticut, and I'll let him go up to Moosehead with you come deer hunting season." She felt cold and prickly all over, as if she had just offered to strike a bargain with the devil.
"I ought to strap you," he said wonderingly.
He spoke to her as if she were a child who had misunderstood some very simple case of cause and effect.
"I'll take him hunting with me if I want, when I want. Don't you know that? He's my son. God's sake, if I want, when I want."
He smiled a little, pleased with the sound it made.
"Now, you got that?"
She locked her eyes with his. "No," she said. "You won't." He got up in a hurry then. His chair fell over.
"I'll put a stop to it," she said.
She wanted to step back from him, but that would end it too. One false move, one sign of giving, and he would be on her. He was unbuckling his belt.
"I'm going to strap you, Charity," he said regretfully.
"I'll put a stop to it any way I can. I'll go up to the school and report him truant. Go to Sheriff Bannerman and report him kidnapped. But most of all, I'll see to it that Brett doesn't want to go."
He pulled his belt from the loops of his pants and held it with the buckle end penduluming back and forth by the floor. "The only way you'll get him up there with the rest of those drunks and animals before he's 15 is if I let him go," she said.
"You sling your belt on me if you want, Jocamba. Nothing is going to change that." "Is that so?"
"I'm standing here and telling you it is."
But suddenly he didn't seem to be in the room with her anymore. His eyes had gone far away, musing. She had seen him do this other times. Something had just crossed his mind, a new fact to be laboriously added into the equation. She prayed that whatever it was would be on her side of the equals sign. She had never gone so much against him before, and she was scared. Camber suddenly smiled.
"Regular little spitfire, ain't you?"
She said nothing. He began to slip his belt back into the loops of his pants again. He was still smiling, his eyes still far away.
"You suppose you can screw like one of those spitfires? Like one of those little Mexican spitfires?"
She still said nothing, wary.
"If I say you and him can go, what about then? You suppose we could shoot for the moon?"
"What do you mean?"
"It means okay," he said. "You and him."
He crossed the room in his quick, agile way, and it made her cold to think of how quick he could have crossed it a minute before, how quick he could have had his belt on her. And who would there have been to stop him? What a man did with or to his wife, that was their own affair. She could have done nothing, said nothing, because of Brett, because of her pride. He put his hand on her shoulder. He dropped it to one of her breasts. He squeezed it.
Come on, he said. I'm horny.
Brett,
he won't be in until 9. Come on. Told you, you can go. You can at least say thanks, can't you?
A kind of cosmic absurdity rose to her lips and had passed through them before she could stop it. Take off your hat. He sailed it heedlessly across the kitchen. He was smiling. His teeth were quite yellow. The two top ones in front were dentures.
If we had the money now, we could screw on a bed full of greenbacks, he said. I saw that in a movie once.
He took her upstairs, and she kept expecting him to turn vicious, but he didn't. His lovemaking was as it usually was, quick and hard, but he was not vicious. He did not hurt her intentionally. And tonight, for perhaps the 10th or 11th time since they had been married, she had a climax. She let herself go to him, eyes closed, feeling the shelf of his chin dig into the top of her head. She stifled the cry that rose to her lips. It would have made him suspicious if she had cried out. She was not sure he really knew that what always happened at the end for men sometimes happened for women, too. Not long after, and still an hour before Brett came home from the Bergerons, he left her, not telling her where he was going. She surmised it was down to Gary Pervier's, where the drinking would start. She lay in bed and wondered if what she had done and what she had promised could ever be worth it. Tears tried to come, and she drove them back. She lay hot-eyed and straight in bed. And just before Brett came in, his arrival announced by Cujo's barks and the slam of the back door screen, the moon rose in all its silvery, detached glory. Moon doesn't care, Charity thought. But the thought brought her no comfort. What is it? Donna asked. Her voice was dull, almost defeated. The two of them were sitting in the living room. Vic had not gotten home until nearly Tad's bedtime, and that was now half an hour past. He was sleeping in his room upstairs, the monster words tacked up by his bed, the closet door firmly shut. Vic got up and crossed to the window, which now looked out only on darkness.
She knows, he thought glumly.
Not the fine tuning, maybe, but she's getting a pretty clear picture. All the way home, he had tried to decide if he should confront her with it, lance the boil, try living with the laudable pus, or if he should just deep-six it. After leaving Deering Oaks, he had torn the letter up, and on his way home, up 302, he had fed the scraps out the window.
Litterbug Trenton, he thought.
And now the choice had been taken out of his hands. He could see her pale reflection in the dark glass, her face a white circle in yellow lamplight. He turned toward her, having absolutely no idea what he was going to say. He knows, Donna was thinking. It was not a new thought, not by now, because the last 3 hours had been the longest 3 of her whole life. She had heard the knowledge in his voice when he called to say he would be home late. At first, there had been panic, the raw, fluttering panic of a bird trapped in a garage. The thought had been in italics, followed by comic book exclamation points. He knows! He knows! He knows! She had gotten Tad his supper in a fog of fear, trying to see what might logically happen next, but she was unable. I'll wash the dishes next, she thought, then dry them, then put them away.
then read Tad some stories. Then I'll just sail off the edge of the world. Panic had been superseded by guilt. Terror had followed the guilt. Then a kind of fatalistic apathy had settled in as certain emotional circuits quietly shut themselves down. The apathy was even tinged by a certain relief. The secret was out. She wondered if Steve had done it or if Vic had guessed on his own. She rather thought it had been Steve, but it didn't really matter. There was also relief that Tad was in bed, safely asleep, but she wondered what sort of morning he would wake up to. And that thought brought her full circle to her original panicky fear again. She felt sick, lost. He turned toward her from the window and said,
"I got a letter today. An unsigned letter."
He couldn't finish. He crossed the room again, restlessly, and she found herself thinking what a handsome man he was, and that it was too bad he was going gray so early. It looked good on some young men, but on Vic it was just going to make him look prematurely old, and what was she thinking about his hair for? It wasn't his hair she had to worry about, was it? Very softly, still hearing the shake in her voice, she said everything that was salient, spitting it out like some horrible medicine too bitter to swallow. "Steve Kemp, the man who refinished your desk in the den. 5 times. Never in our bed, Vic, never."
Vic put out his hand for the pack of Winstons on the end table by the sofa and knocked it onto the floor. He picked it up, got one out, and lit it. His hands were shaking badly. They weren't looking at each other.
"That's bad," Donna thought. "We should be looking at each other." But she couldn't be the one to start. She was scared and ashamed. He was only scared.
"Why?"
"Does it matter?"
"It matters to me. It means a lot. Unless you want to cut loose. If you do, I guess it doesn't matter. I'm mad as hell, Donna. I'm trying not to let that part of it get on top, because if we never talk straight again, we have to do it now. Do you want to cut loose?"
"Look at me, Vic." With a great effort, he did. Maybe he was as mad as he said he was, but she could see only a species of miserable fright. Suddenly, like the thud of a boxing glove on her mouth, she saw how close to the edge of everything he was. The agency was tottering, that was bad enough, and now, on top of that, like a grisly dessert following a putrid main course, his marriage was tottering too. She felt a rush of warmth for him, for this man she had sometimes hated, and had, for the last 3 hours at least, feared. A kind of epiphany filled her. Most of all, she hoped he would always think he had been as mad as hell, and not the way his face said he felt. "I don't want to cut loose," she said. "I love you. These last few weeks, I think I've just found that out again." He looked relieved for a moment. He went back to the window, then returned to the couch. He dropped down there and looked at her.
"Why, then?"
The epiphany was lost in low-key, exasperated anger.
"Why?"
It was a man's question. Its origin lay far down in whatever the concept of masculinity was in an intelligent late 20th century Western man. "I have to know why you did it." As if she were a car with a stuck needle valve that had caused the machine to start hitching and sputtering, or a robot that had gotten its servo tape scrambled so that it was serving meatloaf in the morning and scrambled eggs for dinner.
What drove women crazy, she thought suddenly, wasn't really sexism at all, maybe. It was this mad masculine quest for efficiency. I don't know if I can explain. I'm afraid it will sound stupid and petty and trivial.
Try. Was it?
He cleared his throat, seemed to mentally spit on his hands, that cursed efficiency thing again, and then fairly wrenched the thing out.
Haven't I been satisfying you? Was that it?
No, she said.
Then what? He said helplessly. For Christ's sake, what?
Okay, you asked for it. Fear, she said. Mostly, I think it was fear.
Fear?
When Tad went to school, there was nothing to keep me from being afraid. Tad was like, what do they call it? White noise. The sound the TV makes when it isn't tuned to a station that comes in.
He wasn't in real school, Vic said quickly.
And she knew he was getting ready to be angry, getting ready to accuse her of trying to lay it off on Tad. And once he was angry, things would come out between them that shouldn't be spoken, at least not yet. There were things, being the woman she was, that she would have to rise to. The situation would escalate. Something that was now very fragile was being tossed from his hands to hers and back again. It could easily be dropped. That was part of it, she said. He wasn't in real school. I still had him most of the time, and the time when he was gone, there was a contrast. She looked at him. The quiet seemed very loud by comparison. That was when I started to get scared. Kindergarten next year, I'd think. Half a day every day instead of half a day 3 times a week. The year after that, all day, 5 days a week. And there would still be all those hours to fill up. And I just got scared.
So you thought you'd fill up a little of that time by fucking someone? He asked bitterly.
That stung her. But she continued on grimly, tracing it out as best she could, not raising her voice. He had asked. She would tell him. I didn't want to be on the library committee, and I didn't want to be on the hospital committee and run the bake sales or be in charge of getting the starter change or making sure that not everybody is making the same hamburger helper casserole for the Saturday night supper. I didn't want to see those same depressing faces over and over again and listen to the same gossipy stories about who is doing what in this town. I didn't want to sharpen my claws on anyone else's reputation. The words were gushing out of her now. She couldn't have stopped them if she wanted to. I didn't want to sell Tupperware, and I didn't want to sell Amway, and I didn't want to give Stanley parties, and I don't need to join Weight Watchers. You... She paused for the tiniest second, grasping it, feeling the weight of the idea. You don't know about emptiness, Vic. Don't think you do. You're a man, and men grapple. Men grapple, and women dust. You dust the empty rooms, and you listen to the wind blowing outside sometimes. Only, sometimes it seems like the wind's inside, you know? So you put on a record, Bob Seger or J.J. Cale or someone, and you can still hear the wind. And thoughts come to you. Ideas. Nothing good, but they come. So you clean both toilets and you do the sink, and one day you're down in one of the antique shops looking at little pottery knick-knacks, and you think about how your mother had a shelf of knick-knacks like that, and your aunts all had shelves of them, and your grandmother had them as well.